Leo Brown, almost hour. And when I say back, I mean on, because they do that. Welcome to the show. Holy week, holy Thursday. Tomorrow, Good Friday. Easter Saturday. On until Easter Sunday. So one of the most celebratory times of the church, one of the most solemn times of the church for the next few days as we reflect. We'll do a little bit of that. Thanks to Jessica Musman Griffith, who has posted a lovely tribute to Holy Week on her Pathos blog, and we posted it over on the Breadbox Media page as well. We'll look at that a little bit later on. And also, President Trump and chocolate cake, and did the missiles head towards Syria or Iraq? I guess they landed in Syria, even though in recounting the story, he clearly suggests it was Iraq where they went. And then, of course, the many, 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 many flip-flops that we see happening now. I think we have to look at some of these and hopefully ask some questions. We'll get into all of that. All of this and more this afternoon. I'm Leo Brown. Leo Brown, almost hour. Back in a moment. Leo Brown, almost our culture, current events, Catholic stuff, Catholic things, whatever I say, whatever I normally say, that's it. Even if what I just said then wasn't what I normally say, because I never know what's going to come out of my mouth. Kind of like apparently what happened with the declaration of Lansing, Michigan being a sanctuary city last week. And this week saying, no. We were just joking. That thing last week? No, that's not for real. This is how we're going to do it. Which, politics, when it's led by committees, led by a city council, right? This happens. When you have votes, when you have parties involved that could sway influence depending on the day, depending on the meeting, depending on the session, right? This is what happens. Congressional sessions are the same way. Congressional committees are the same way. It's true of assemblies on the state level. It's true of councils in cities. This happens. You can easily declare yourself one thing, and then a majority vote comes in and changes that. And I think that's why, it's why we want to put our brand of politician in the majority. That's what we want. We want a majority to rule. We want to be able to say, this is how this is going to work, and this is what we anticipate, this is what we expect. We've put you there because we think you've got some sort of consistency. We appreciate that consistency, and we want to continue to see that happen, right? That's why we do this voting thing with politicians that we hope will have our back and what we believe. So I made no secrets about this when it came to voting this past presidential election. We had a Senate and a congressional seat on the ballot as well. My vote for that congressman and for that senator was as conservative as the day is long. They are both with proven track records. One, Rand Paul in my state. Some people love him. Some people hate him. He will hold politicians' feet to the fire. He will make sure that he has bipartisan support on issues. He will challenge his own party. He's done this repeatedly. Andy Barr, the congressman, not quite the reputation of Barr when it comes to, Paul, when it comes to doing things of that nature, but very consistent, very straight down the conservative path. He's been that way his entire time of Congress. And these are a couple of guys that I know will not surprise me. They will not surprise me. There's nothing they could do that I would be like, where did this come from? They've proven themselves. They have a tremendous consistency. Now, I was berated. I have lost friends on Facebook. I think I've lost friends in real life because I would not put the same degree of trust and support behind President Trump in the election because I said, I don't know that we can trust this guy. That's what I said. I don't know that he's got your back. I don't know that he's going to be as consistent as these other individuals. This is what I said. This was my primary criticism. Go back and check. I wasn't saying this guy is not conservative enough or this guy is not, or he's too liberal or he's this or he's that or he's, I don't like his policy platform. I simply said, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what he's saying now because it will be different. Maybe within the first month, maybe within the first year, sometime in that four-year term, should he serve at all, he will change completely from what you think you're going to get to what you will get. It's what he's always done. Now, why? There's a zillion possibilities, but the fact is he will flip-flop everything. And he proved this in the election. One of his crusade, if you recall, Donald Trump on the birth issue for President Obama. He was convinced that Obama was an illegal president, that he was not born in the U.S., went on and on and on and on. And then one day, it was the most insignificant thing that has ever existed in his world. It was like, forget about that. Remember that? Do you remember also that he was bent on convicting, not just investigating further, not just trying to get to the bottom of scandal, but putting Hillary Clinton behind bars? Do you recall how many times he said that? That under my administration, there will be a special prosecutor. There will be someone to get to the bottom of all of this scandal, and you will be behind bars. This was a pledge and a promise. I know voters who loved that rhetoric so much because they had such disdain for Clinton. They voted for Trump strictly on that policy that seemed to be a passion for him to see Hillary Clinton rot in jail because of whatever infractions she had as Secretary of State, as a senator, whatever, impropriety, unethical, you name it, she's going and rotting behind bars. Do you recall that? What did he do immediately upon getting elected? Nah, the Clintons have had their own problems. Had enough of them. We don't need to add to it. So it's bizarre to see someone so convicted, so completely focused that there's no question, it's unflinchingly convicted, only to just let that go. Now, I understand having moodiness or things that will grip you almost in an infatuation, right? I mean, we all do that. We have these things that are infatuous to us and that they, and even seasonal. And I know that I've been geeked. I get geeked into things. I'll get very geeked. I'll be like golf, for instance. I was so geeked into golf that I played four or five times a week. But then kids came along, dynamics changed. And I'm like, I can't do that anymore, right? I can't put that time into that. Prior to golf, I was avid as a cyclist. I was always out riding my bike, either trail riding or road riding. But, you know, I was single then, and there was a liability issue there that I didn't have anyone relying on me at all. And I go do whatever I want to do, right? As dangerous. And I did a lot of dangerous stuff. I kayaked, I snowboarded, I, you know, was always out just being crazy, active, doing stuff that I realized, okay, well, this has got to change. And so, you know, my changes when it comes to the things that I've been passionately focused in, geekishly, not really passionately, geekishly, have been kind of seasonal because of the state in life and what I happen to be doing. Right now, if you know me, if you follow me on Facebook, I'm pretty geeked into my music. But I've been that way. I've never not, right? I'm deeper, more deeply geeked now, yes, but I've never not had that avid pursuit of a musical hobby. It's something I've always had. So it just kind of bubbled up a little bit more, and I'm doing more things now than I have in a long time, but it's not that it's new, not by any means. So I say this to say, you know, we see that in people, and it's happened in my life, and I get it. But ask about my convictions. Ask about what I believe. I've never, even in my most extreme, if you will, selfish behavior, like truly the most selfish of selfishness, I would not for a moment compromise the dignity of others. Just wouldn't do it. I had a bigger temper then, and I would lash into individuals because I was pressed and I was hot-headed. But when it came to looking at individuals in their inherent dignity, and I didn't realize why I had this ethic or what it really meant or anything, I just knew that I always took up for the little guy. Always, always. Even as a kid, I would go and fight the bullies that picked on the little guys, right? And that's still the same consistent ethic that I have now, and it guides everything that I do when it comes to my faith. My faith is hinged on human dignity. And it's as I've said many times, you've heard me say this, if you can't be a good humanist first, forget about being a Christian. Because if you treat people like dirt and you're a jerk to them and you discredit and discount them, while at the same time proclaiming some kind of faith, what consistency do you have? You have no witness, none. So we've got a president now who's changed his mind on major, major promises, on major issues. We haven't even gotten into them yet, really, when it comes to everything. But next segment, we're going to dig into some of this. China, Russia, NATO. These are just a few that were big, big policy platform issues that now seem to not even have any of the same teeth that they had before. We'll talk about this more in a moment. I'm Leo Brown, Leo Brown Almost Hour, back after this. Back, I'm Leo Brown, Leo Brown Almost Hour. Culture, current events, Catholic things. 50 minutes every afternoon. So the last time I was talking about this, consistency that I think is important. It's important in leadership. It's a friend of mine on Facebook said, yeah, and humility, right? It's there's something humbling or, I guess, comforting about somebody who is humble enough to say, you know, we just kind of really got to watch the course on this and see where it's going to lead. I think based on what I'm watching, I anticipate this, but, you know, time is only, we're only going to learn in time. We're only going to learn from this rather than having this definitive certainty about everything that would seem to suggest that you get all the answers when you really don't. Nobody does, right? We can say, look, I know what I anticipate. I know what I expect. I know what I want to see. And then let the course take its course, and we're along for the ride. We're focused but flexible, and we're going to see where things lead. That's one thing. But to make very definitive statements, such as China is a currency manipulator, and they're doing crazy things economically to basically cook their books, is what the president was suggesting. And then when he meets with the Chinese president, has chocolate cake, falls in love, and there's a bromance there, and apparently a better bromance than Putin, now he's saying, these guys are good to go. We're the ones with the problems, right? So that's a concern. It's a pretty big concern. Or you say, you know what, NATO's obsolete. And there are those who were maverick, if you want to say it that way, or extreme enough to say, we need to be on our own here. Who needs a NATO? They're not carrying their weight. Then to come back and say, we kind of do need NATO. That stuff that I said before, no, that's not right. Or to say, we're going to have the best relationship with Russia that has ever been, and then to come out and say, yeah, it's probably the worst it's ever been. Oh, which is it? I get not necessarily knowing all the answers. Nobody does. And again, the humility that simply says, we don't know the answers. Here's what we're going to try. Here's what we're going to do with every ounce of effort. We're going to do this as effectively as we possibly can because we want to see these results. We want these results. It's kind of what I said before. Make America great again. Is that what you're going to stand on? Okay. Are you going to stand on that and say, we're going to make America great again so we can then help others? Because now we're talking, right? If you're going to say, because that's the old adage. Well, Leo, you got to put your oxygen mask on first, right? Okay. Yes. So you can help others. But it's not so I can jump out of the plane and forget about everybody else, which, you know, that's another thing. But is that oxygen mask going to do a whole heck of a lot in a plane crash? Really? I mean, but anyway, that's beside the point. The ethic is, it has to be, I'm doing this so I can position myself better for others. That's how this works, right? That's how this works. We've talked about it before. The heaven and hell look exactly the same. But this is not theological, okay? This is the old adage. One, in one place, there are frustrated diners who can't get too long of chopsticks. They can't get the food in their mouth because the chopsticks are too long. They can't feed themselves. The other, in heaven, are using the same chopsticks. They're just feeding each other, right? I mean, once we understand that we truly, truly, truly show that we love God by how we love others, we don't show that we love God by how frequently go to Mass. Go to Mass if it helps you every day, if it helps you love others. Do that, yes. Frequently receive the Eucharist if it helps you love others. Get deep into Scripture and learn as much as you can if it helps you love others. But if all that does is isolate you, if all it does is build this thicker wall around you and it puts you into this separatist mode of you whatever are so into your spirituality now that you can't even relate with others, or worse, that all you do is judge everything by everything anyone does. They're not worthy. They can't be here. They're sinful. Oh, I'll pray for them. Yeah, that's what I'll do. I'll pray for them. No, maybe just engage with them. I've shared this story. It was years and years and years ago. I'm at a town hall forum kind of open meeting with the bishop. And this was our prior bishop. He had been on the job for maybe about a year. and he was somewhat unpopular after some staffing decisions that he made. He got rid of some individuals that had respected positions, people knew. And there was a woman who just literally lit into him in this meeting. I mean, as tirade as you could possibly ever imagine. And it just so happens, this was before kids, but I guess I would say, generally I would say I was out with my kids because that's usually what happens, but I was doing something with the event, so I don't know if I'd gone to get something, whatever. We literally met each other in the narthex of the church. This woman who I'd watched just rip the bishop a new one. And some way, somehow, we struck up a conversation. In a span of 10 minutes, maybe 15 or 20, I learned so much about the pain of this woman's life. And so much about the frustration that she had personally as an individual that had nothing to do with the bishop, had nothing to do with the church, really. It had to do with her experience. And during that time, I was simply listening and encouraging and suggesting this or that. I felt like I understand everything that came out of that woman's mouth, which I know that there were those who just wanted her, you know, they wanted to trump her out, right? Trump her out of here, right? Get her out of here. She doesn't belong. And it wasn't my choice to pursue her and go, I need to go meet this woman to find out what her pain is. It just happened. But it was such a turning point for me in that experience to know that those who seem to be the most, the biggest agitators are generally just the most broken. They're generally just the most hurt. And when someone is in that pain, when someone is always feeling backed into that corner, when they're always convinced that there's something that just is unjust or unfair or simply just painful to them, right? It's just painful. This woman's pain was immeasurable of the, and it was a grace moment that she was willing to share this with me. And it was a grace moment to glimpse into that. If I look at her with any type of disregard, then I have violated the foundational ethics of my faith, which says, as Jesus is very clear, what you do for the least of these, you do for me. Now, who are the least of these? They're not just those who are poor or who are infirmed or who are in these clearly, which should be obvious states of need, which, of course, there's the now popular approach. Well, those are Christian people, right? Those are the ones Jesus was talking about. The least of these, my brothers. He clearly says my brothers because he means Christians. Wow. Okay. Thank you. Thanks for that point of clarification. Good. I can treat everybody else like dung. But if we understand that it's not just those that are so obviously in this state of need, but those who may not appear to be in any need, but they just appear to be agitated, right? They just appear to be aggressive. They appear to be oppositional to whatever it is that you're presenting. Can we love them? Can we give them the time to engage? Like I say, at this moment, it was there, I was there. I'm like, I need to listen to this woman. She wanted just someone to listen to her. She wanted the bishop to listen to her, and he did. He did, and I was impressed. I got to admit, I was so impressed at his demeanor. He did not, it was as if he didn't flinch against any of the attack. It was amazing. I was so impressed with his ability to handle that. And, you know, I wanted to defend him, right? That's when the stand up and say, wait a minute, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, That was my initial reaction. I think it was the reaction of many in there. But then to encounter her in that one-to-one and simply say, you know what, I'm just going to love you. As crazy as that sounds and as creepy and weird, and it's not, but it's just, I'm just going to love you in this moment. I'm going to open my heart to you. I'm going to let you tell me what you need to tell me, because you got something you need to tell me. You got something you need to get off your heart. And can we heal each other that way? Would we be willing to love like that? Because that's what God wants. That's kind of the key to all of this. Will we love like that? So I'm sorry, I got on a tangent here. We'll talk more coming up. I'm Leo Brown, Leo Brown Almost Hour, back after this. Our culture, current events, Catholic things, 50 minutes every afternoon. Mentioned this at the start of the show, Holy Week, Jessica Mesman Griffith with a beautiful experiential reflection of her time at Mass on Palm Sunday when we have this account of the crucifixion. And certainly I know that this is an incredibly moving account for many, but honestly, I guess I'm just too unsentimental, right? I have too much coldness of my heart. While I go there, yeah, it's not like watching The Passion of the Christ for me. That movie, which I've only seen once, even though I own it, was just the absolute most moving experience ever, recounting the crucifixion. But as Jessica talks about in this piece, which is on the Breadbox Media page and shared on my personal page on Facebook, she talks about this, why she cries every time, right? That she experiences this retelling. And, you know, it's real. That's the beauty of it, right? This is a historical account. This is not something that we look at as others would accuse of it being, that it's some sort of fairy tale story. We as Catholics, as Christians, as people of faith, we look at this historically and we say, this really happened, right? And even if Jesus knew that tear down the temple, in 3 days it'll be rebuilt. In his human being, in his 100% humanness, he experienced that tragedy, that pain, that rejection, that humiliation. Yeah, and that's one thing. I think that we don't really think about it. Even those who, and I know that there are those who are more than comfortable with public nudity. They'll be naked anywhere. I've got a 4-year-old who is that way. I wasn't that way as a child. I was always modest. My 4-year-old likes to be naked around people, and he'll pretty much do it anywhere, anytime. I kind of sense that's not going away in him. I think he's kind of that guy. And I knew them growing up, right? That strip off clothes, jump in the water. It was just a thing you did. It was more convenient to do that than to have swim trunks standing by, or to have to change out of your underwear or shorts or wear them wet. That was just like skinny dipping was a thing. You just did it. I grew up in the country. Guys, girls, everybody would strip down and jump in. I was never that comfortable. Just so you know. So it's odd as it is, it's one of the elements to the crucifixion that I find most riveting, is that he was stripped naked. We see the accounts, so they're not X-rated, with a loincloth on Jesus. That's not how he was crucified. That's, he was stripped of his garments. It's clear. So here he is to be shown a Jew, right? He has to be seen as a Jew. It's obvious. He's crucified. He's circumcised as he's being crucified. And I don't know that we think about that, and maybe because it's creepy or it's weird or it's nasty. No, it's humility. It's humbling. He was stripped naked on the cross for all to see. Every bit of his humanity. Every bit of his manhood on display. And that, to me, is one of the most riveting, because I know I would not want that. I know I would not want to be displayed like that. I would not. It has nothing to do with my comfort of endowment. It has to do with just that's a private thing, right? That's a personal thing. That's something that, and think about it. I mean, this was, circumcision was the sign of the Jew, but who saw that, right? Wasn't generally the case that men walked around naked. Other men might see them in certain places, and their spouse, their lover, that was it, right? So when we think about where this takes us, especially from a point of theology of the body, and I hope to talk to Father Thomas Loya about this tomorrow, because I really want to explore this, that here is Jesus displayed for all of us to, in what would be a very private, right? What would be a very personal, intimate experience to see someone in total nakedness. But here he is on a cross, not just in public, but above the heads of the crowd, so everyone can see him hanging on the cross, beaten, bloody, stripped naked, dying. Is there more humiliating anything than that? The most undignified way that anyone could perish. And this is what he did. This is what he accepted. For us to go, you know what? It's worth me trying to get this right. It's worth me trying to embrace the grace that is there for me. It's worth me trying to live an exemplary life. It's worth me trying to be the one who stands up for the little guy. It's worth me trying to be the one who makes takes every possible opportunity to take the high road, to go down that path less traveled, to be the one who is trying to get it right only through grace, only through the grace of that incident, that experience, that total humbling of oneself. I commented on Mike Allen's post earlier. He was talking about John's account, which we'll hear tonight, Holy Thursday, that is obviously different than the other three gospel accounts, the synoptics, we call them, being somewhat synonymous of one another. And here's John throwing this odd account with no account of the supper, but only of the foot washing, only Jesus taking the form of a servant. And this has been presented by some as being, well, it's just metaphorical of this is, yeah, we're supposed to serve each other. No, I believe Jesus did it, yes. And I believe what's more powerful, the metaphor, is allegory. Allegory says this happened. It's an account. It's contextual and historical, while at the same time saying something else. It's a double meaning. So that allegory here, yes, its historical occurrence is significant. But more importantly, it is, what do we do Eucharistically? What do we do? Are we people of service? Do we take the time to serve others? I mean, as we understand this foot washing, this was done. I mean, think about that. You know, you walk up to a place, you're dusty and dirty and whatever from traveling in sandals, and you kick off your sandals and somebody washes your feet before you enter the home or the place of worship or the business, whatever. That's got to be somebody's job, right? That's a pretty disgusting job, that someone would be forced into that role, a lowly role of washing feet. Shining shoes is humiliating enough, but washing feet? And this is what Jesus does. And says, okay, whatever the humiliating thing is, whatever that thing is, that's what we're supposed to do. Whatever that least thing that you would imagine would be what you want to be doing, that's what you need to do. Now, I've shared in Startup here with Breadbox Media, I have a lot of side projects going to keep food on the table, and one of those is waiting tables. And that's kind of a humbling thing to do when you're 48 years old, right? To go back into the restaurant business, which I did as a 20-year-old and always had cash in my pocket, fortunately. So that's why I'm back. I knew that I could make quick cash. But you're talking about a role of a servant and having to be there at the beck and call and to deliver food and to be the guy who's taking care of diners, patrons. I love the restaurant. I love the environment. I love the food. I love the place. But I have to take that role of a servant. And it's not necessarily fun, especially at my age, when my friends are retiring because they got into their careers right out of college. And it's like, I've been at this for 30 years, so guess I can retire now. To be basically working like I was right out of college. Well, I still was in college, right? And I'm not saying that to say, look at me, but sometimes we just got to go, okay, so it's humbling, so we do it. Whatever that is, we take the form of a servant. That's all we have time for this afternoon. I'm Leo Brown, Leo Brown Almost Hour. God bless.